The time's 4 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at WERU.org. All About Aging with your host Peg Cruikshank is up next.
All About Aging, this is Peg Cruikshank. Today's topic is Death with Dignity, the New Maine Law. No call-ins today on this program, but listeners are welcome to email comments about Death with Dignity in response to what you hear from our speakers or any other concerns you have about this new Maine law. Our guests are Valerie Lovelace, who's the Executive Director of Maine Death with Dignity, and Patricia Hymanson, the sponsor of the bill in the legislature. Patricia is the chair of the Joint Committee on Health and Human Services. We will also have some comment from hospice officials who have concerns about Death with Dignity. Although they weren't able to come on the program today, they have sent in some statements that I can read so that we get some balance. Before turning to Death with Dignity, though, I want to go back to last month's topic of ageism discussed by Mary Lou Cioffi of University of New England. After that program, I discovered that the January-February issue of the AARP Bulletin has a special section on workplace discrimination. That's the current issue. AARP says age discrimination, quote, remains a significant and costly problem for workers, their families, and our economy. Ageism appears in three main areas. First, in recruitment and hiring. Secondly, on the job itself, through bias or harassment or promotions denied. And thirdly, termination, getting fired. Companies trim their budgets by targeting senior employees. Several examples of workers forced out after they were told they were too old for the job are featured in this issue of the AARP Bulletin. The researchers at AARP found 4,700 LinkedIn ads for recent college graduates. Obviously, those 4,800 employers are not thinking of mature workers. AARP thinks the law should change to allow compensatory and punitive damages for people who've been discriminated against on the basis of age. At Ohio State, two instructors were called Deadwood and Millstones. They were in their early 60s. They won a rare victory. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission awarded them $765,000, a very rare victory for people who are suing for age discrimination. Other language that's discriminatory, according to AARP, fossils, old school, digitally illiterate, and geezer. I'm interested in that last term, geezer, because it used to be a neutral term for someone who was a mummer in England in one of the folk dances. The mummer was disguised. So geezer was just someone in disguise. Now it can mean old men. And apparently it's also been extended, thanks to equal rights for women, to old women. So if you're an old woman, you too can be called a geezer. Mark Zuckerberg was quoted as saying, young people are just smarter. The problem here is seeing a mass of people instead of seeing individuals. Some individual, of course, may be smarter or dumber. AARP thinks that people who want to sue for age discrimination will have better luck with state courts than with federal courts, where they have to prove that age discrimination is the only reason for getting fired. This is hard and a tougher standard than for racism and sexism. Of thousands of age discrimination cases sent to EEOC, only a few result in settlements. There's a book about ageism at work. It's called I'm Not Done. The author is Patty Temple Rocks. Sometimes workers structure their resume to hide their age. I believe I once did that, knocking off about 10 years of employment. Here's some statistics. 3 in 5 older workers have seen or have experienced ageism in the workplace. 76% of these workers see age discrimination as a hurdle to finding a new job. Of the workers who are pushed out of jobs, 90% never earn as much again. However, one executive said, older workers have an enormous amount of intellectual property in their heads, and losing that knowledge causes companies to lose capital. That should make them think twice about firing the people with intellectual property in their heads. Since this topic, age discrimination at work, is not often discussed, I would like to hear from Mainers who listen to the program who have experienced age discrimination at work. They can be anonymous. Send an email to news@weru.org. Now let's turn to Valerie Lovelace. She has just returned from a conference in Berkeley, the first national conference, Val, about medically assisted dying. Is that right?
Yes, it was the National Clinicians Conference on Medical Aid in Dying.
How many people were there?
There were a little over 300.
Ooh, well. And do you want to tell us a few things about that conference before we talk about the main situation with death with dignity?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to start with a definition of what death with dignity or medically assisted dying means in the United States. So that is currently legal in 10 U.S. jurisdictions.
Yes, 10.
Are you still there?
Oh, yes.
Okay, sorry, we got interrupted, it sounded like. But I find that a lot of people are confused on exactly what it means. So this description includes the Maine Death with Dignity Act. What medically assisted dying in the U.S. means is the legal prescribing of a dose of medication a patient will then self-ingest at a time of their choosing. It's a lethal quantity of medication. It's written by a consenting physician at the formal request of a qualified terminally ill adult patient. And that's really important. They have to qualify to certain criteria, and they must be diagnosed with a terminal illness, having a six-month prognosis, which is the same medical model that's used for patients' eligibility for hospice. And it follows a legally defined safeguarded process for those states that have the law.
Diane Reem said the other day on Maine Calling that there were 9 states that have death with dignity. One
yes.
has been added since she spoke the other day.
No, that's 10 U.S. jurisdictions, so that's 9 states and Washington, D.C.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. 9
sure.
states and Washington, D.C. The self-ingested part of this law is really important, isn't it? Because it differentiates itself from a doctor-assisted suicide or a relative.
Yes, and actually, even, you know, the term physician-assisted suicide was coined many years ago, and it's actually inappropriate to this conversation. So medically and legally, these laws are not defined as a suicide. I understand that, you know, philosophically we can argue all day long whether it is a suicide or not, but medically and legally it is not viewed as such, nor is it responded to as such. And the fact that the patient does have to ingest the medication on their own really differentiates it from something like euthanasia, where a physician would have it play an active role in administering medication to a patient. Currently, euthanasia is not legal anywhere in the United States.
That's an important point, Valerie. Not suicide legally or what was the other, or
medically,
not legally or medically. Yes. Okay. So what was the conference like? Can you give a kind of feeling about it, or the, must have been exciting to be at the first national conference of something.
It was very exciting for me, to hear from clinicians, and practitioners across the country who have more experience than the state of Maine has. So, as you know, our law passed last September, went into effect September 19th of 2019. So we're still learning our way forward with it. At the conference, there were physicians and hospice workers and clergy members and others who were from states like Colorado. Colorado and Oregon and Washington, who had much more, you know, many more years experience in some cases with implementing the laws in their state. So it was truly more information than I've been able to process so far. But what I particularly liked about it was the collaborative effort among physicians and hospice workers and healthcare agencies as they integrate with the law and a patient's right to access the law and include it as part of a continuum of care to ensure that patients are still are receiving the best care they possibly can.
Well, I'm really glad you were free to be on the air with us today, Valerie, because this is, as you say, a new law, isn't it? Just passed last September. Lots
right.
of people probably don't have a very good idea of what it is. I know you've been giving talks around the state to clarify the issues.
Yes. Here in Maine, a lot of folks are unaware of the fact that Maine has actually tried off and on to pass a law of this nature since 1994, which is the same year that Oregon's first attempt went into effect. So I think it's important, you know, whether an individual supports these decisions or not, particularly if they're healthcare providers or clergy members, I think it's really important they be educated on the facts, exactly what is this law and how do Mainers access it, because patients are going to ask about it. So, whether a provider supports or doesn't support, they need to respond with accurate information so the patient can find access the way they need to find access, even if that particular provider won't be participating.
That's a good point. Why do you think it's taken Maine so long to pass this law? Maybe that's an unanswerable question. But
it's a great question. I feel like when I observe progress in other states, and even here in Maine, it really takes a very consistent effort, and here in Maine so there was a consistent effort, and then it was sort of left alone for a while, and then some other people picked it up, and there was some more effort, and then it was left alone for a while, and so what all I can say is I've been involved since the last three legislative sessions, and it does take continually raising awareness, growing a support base, and helping the legislature understand that Maine citizens are really interested in this. You know, we did a small survey back in 2017, and that survey showed that about 73% of Mainers support a patient's right to have assistance when they're dying, if they're dying badly, and want access to a law like this.
That's an important statistic. It certainly suggests a lot of growth and support since 1994. Did you have a personal interest in seeing this law passed, Val?
I do, but, generally folks assume that I experienced a very bad death in my family, and that's actually not the case. But I did experience some pretty awful ways people can die when I was a hospice volunteer. Hospice and palliative care is wonderful service that can actually support most patients as they're dying. But there are some individual deaths that just don't respond well to current practices, and that sort of informed my need to really become very active in supporting this law. I'm also a supporter of autonomy, so I feel like if this conversation, when you bring it down to the very personal level of what an individual wants, what do you want when you're dying, and what do I want when I'm dying? It takes on a very different tone than if we're talking, generally what people should or shouldn't be allowed to do when they're dying. I feel like if you're a dying human being, you should have what you need at your disposal to make that an okay process for you.
What are some of the questions that people ask about death with dignity, Valerie, when you're speaking in various settings?
Well, one of the most common misconceptions people ask about is they believe they can put this in their advance directive that they can have a family member act on their behalf to help them get access to the Death with Dignity law, and that is absolutely not true. This is a process that has to actually be initiated by the patient. The patient has to remain in control of their decision-making abilities throughout the process. So that excludes individuals who are in late stage with dementia-related diseases. So that's probably one of the most common. And then the second most common, of course, is how do I find a physician and how do I access the law when I need it? And that's, again, because we're just starting out, that's sort of a bit of a difficult process. So what I recommend to patients is they have a conversation now with their physician. The law doesn't prohibit you from talking with your physician about this. And I think it's really important, rather than ask, you know, doc, how do you feel about the Maine Death with Dignity Act, I would ask very specific questions. So, for instance, if you're my physician, I would ask you, will you write a prescription for me if I qualify under the Maine Death with Dignity Act when that time comes? So it's very clear that I'm asking my physician, will you support my decision by helping me to qualify and then writing that prescription? And I encourage care providers, physicians, and others to respond honestly. If you're morally opposed to the law, say so. Don't leave your patient hanging without information. You know, provide the correct information to your patient and then simply and respectfully say, this is not something I support. So the patient can be very clear on what their next steps may need to be.
Could the doctor say to the patient, I'm opposed to this, but Dr. So-and-so down the road has experienced death with dignity and will be able to talk to you about this choice?
That is entirely up to the physician. What the law specifically states is that if a patient requests their records be transferred to another physician, then their physician must honor that request and must transfer the records.
I want to turn for a moment to some comments on death with dignity from Diane Rehm, who was on Maine Calling the other day. She has a new book out called When My Time Comes. And she told on the program a sad story of her husband's death. It was not legal to end his life by choice. I guess they were in Maryland. So he had to starve himself. And she watched him suffer for 10 days before he died.
Right.
She told us that Death with Dignity lost in Maryland by one vote. Legislators will try again.
Yes.
She said the lobbyists with most money there and nationally, the Catholic Church. I know the Catholic Church has opposed it in Maine, and later on I have a statement that will clarify that. Mm-hmm. Also, Diane Rehm says people who want a choice must do more than write it down. They must talk to people about it, tell people what their wishes are. She says writing it down is no guarantee that their wishes will be honored. I think that was a point you made earlier.
Yes, that's true.
Diane Rehm said it's awkward to have a conversation with an older person who's in bad shape, but you could introduce it by saying, I'm thinking about my own death. That might encourage the person who has a terminal diagnosis to say something about how he or she feels facing death. She also pointed out that for some Black people, it might be hard to make this option because of the distrust of the medical system, which she pointed out was certainly justified because of the Tuskegee experiments that men were given syphilis to see what would
would
happen. So that some education would be needed, I think, in communities where there would be a history of distrust. I have a note here, Valerie, on some opposition to the Death with Dignity, and I thought I'd just run those by you and get a response. These were online from a lawyer named Natalie Rigoli. She takes no position herself, but she presents the pros and the cons. Since you're presenting the pros today, I'll just go over what she says opponents believe about this death with dignity. First, it goes against the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. Secondly, it will force dying patients to end their lives for fear of being a burden to the family. Third, it's morally unethical, according to opponents of death with dignity. And four, it can be abused for monetary gain by unscrupulous individuals. How would you respond to any of those objections to?
First, I would say that those are common comments that the opposition makes. And I think first and foremost, it's really important to note that this so-called slippery slope argument that, you know, people will be forced into making this decision or will be coerced into it. In the over nearly 50 years of collective experience of these laws being active in the states where they have been passed, there is no evidence that any of that has ever occurred. The process is very rigorous. It is very closely controlled and safeguarded. And opposition, while they like to say these things, they cannot produce a court case or evidence that it has occurred. So it's very easy to say, well, this would happen or this could happen. But the fact is, it has not happened. For the Hippocratic Oath, I think it's important to recognize first that not every physician takes that oath. Many physicians take either modified oaths or don't take an oath at all. And the requirement in the oath to do no harm means different things to different physicians. So some physicians feel like they're doing harm if they prolong the dying process of a patient, and they feel like this is the more compassionate option if a patient wants to use the Death with Dignity Act, and they therefore support them in that because they feel to do otherwise would be doing harm to their patients. So I think, you know, there's a lot of diversity and different viewpoints on this issue. I think people need to follow their own conscience, and if a physician is willing to support patient decisions and a patient wants to apply for this, I think that should be respected.
You're listening to WERU-FM. This is All About Aging with host Peg Cruikshank. Today we're talking about death with dignity. Our guest is Valerie Lovelace from the Maine Death with Dignity organization. And if you have comments or questions for Valerie, or if you have other things to say about death with dignity, you can send us an email at news@weru.org. All right, Val, did you have any more comments to refute the opposition? How about the one that it's unethical?
Well, I think ethics can be argued from many different perspectives. I have actually met a medical ethicist, or actually two medical ethicists, who do not believe this is unethical. So again, I think those are personal opinions. To state, you know, for everyone that this is morally wrong, I think is a mistake. It may be morally wrong to some people, and if so, they don't have to choose it. And a physician doesn't have to participate if they have a moral objection. But for those who don't view it as a moral problem, I think, again, that has to be respected. The law is in effect. This allows people who want this choice to have it, and it protects people who don't want this choice, so they don't have to have it.
Could you give us a description of the process? I know two physicians have to be involved. And tell us a little about this cocktail that would be used to end a
person's life. Sure. So to clarify the process, first and foremost, the patient must have a terminal condition, a terminal illness with a six-month or less prognosis that has been confirmed by two physicians. So this would be their attending physician or the physician who is responsible for their current health condition. And then a consulting physician who will confirm the diagnosis, the prognosis, and the mental status of the patient. So the patient has to be able to make their own healthcare decisions throughout the course of their illness, and they also have to be physically capable to self-administer the medication once they receive it. Both physicians are required to confirm that the patient has the mental capacity to be making the decision, as well as the diagnosis and prognosis. If either physician is in doubt of that, they're required to refer the patient for a mental health evaluation. And at that point, the process would stop until the patient is cleared for mental capacity. For the patient themselves, they have to initiate a formal verbal request with their physician, and then 15 days later, they have to initiate a second verbal request with that same physician. At any point in there, that written the patient's written request, which has to be signed by two witnesses, can be submitted. But the 15-day wait period, which actually probably ends up being longer, allows the physician to set up the referral for the consulting physician. It allows the paperwork to be processed and gives some time for the patient to consider their decision, talk with their family, consult with their clergy if they want to during this process. If the patient does qualify, the prescription, then there's another 48-hour waiting period for the physician to write that prescription. Of course, if they don't qualify, then the process stops and nothing can move forward.
And tell us about the actual cocktail, I think you've called it.
Currently, in practice in the United States, this is a compounded formula. It has four different medicines components in it. I'm not a physician, so I can't speak intelligently to what those are or the quantities or how it all works. But it's a compounded formula. It's dissolved basically in 4 to 6 ounces of water, and then the patient will take it if and when they choose. So generally speaking, physicians recommend to the patients not to have the prescription filled at all until they are feeling ready to use it. Then they have it filled, mix it with the 2 to 4 ounces of water, and ingest it. About 65% of the people who qualify for the medication actually use it. The others say they just feel better having it available. It does have a palliative effect to know that, you know, you've got a backup plan. If things go well with your dying process and you do well and you die without it, that's great. But people like to know they have it available to them if things get pretty rough and they feel like they need to use it.
That's a very interesting statistic, 65%. So a lot of people decide not to use it. Are those statistics from Oregon, for example?
Yes, the Oregon, Washington, and Vermont websites have public reports that anyone can access to take a look at how the law is being used in those states.
And I suppose, am I right in guessing that this compound is adjusted somehow to take into account, for example, the weight of the person?
Yes, weight's considered. The other thing that physicians consider is the physical disease that the patient has. So, for instance, because these medications are taken into the digestive system, if there's a pathology that causes, say, an interruption of absorption or things like that, they may further adjust the compound to accommodate that. Those deaths do tend to be a little bit slower coming about than patients who ingest this medication who don't have problems with their digestive tract.
I have a question about mental status here, Valerie. I think it's clear from people who've been around people who've been diagnosed with dementia that they have some lucid periods and some incoherent periods. So
yes.
I wonder how that fits in here. And also I imagine that someone who's severely crippled, say from rheumatoid arthritis, would not be able physically to pick up that compound and use it herself. But what about that mental status and the fact that that's a kind of, it could be sometimes a very ambiguous status?
Well, I think the important thing is to remember, first of all, the individual has to have a terminal illness with a 6-month prognosis. So in my limited experience, the individuals that I am aware of who have dementia-related diseases, by the time they are considered terminal with that disease within 6 months, they have no capacity for decision-making. And so, again, physicians have tools where they can determine if a patient is capable of making their decisions, if they understand the decision they're making. And if there's any doubt, the physician simply won't move forward with that patient.
Well, that's a good safeguard, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to switch now from the phone with Valerie Lovelace, the director of Death with Dignity in Maine, and we're going to chat briefly with Patricia Hymanson, the state legislator who introduced this bill. She's a neurologist, and she's chair of the Committee on Health and Human Services in the legislature. It'll take us just a minute to click on to Patricia Hymanson. Okay. Have we got you, Patricia? All right. Well, we'll keep trying here. I thought it was important to have some comment from the woman who is responsible for getting this legislation into Maine. And the fact that she's a doctor is particularly interesting because I'm assuming she has seen very painful deaths of patients and was hoping that Maine could be one of the few states that had an alternative for the dying process. Hi, Patricia, are you there? The same woman who put the online notice on the pros and cons of Death with Dignity, Valerie and I were talking about the cons, and Valerie was going over them. Here's what she says about the pros. This is Natalie Rigoli. Pros of Death with Dignity Act gives a person the right to die and his or her suffering when he or she wants to be spared from excruciating pain. Secondly, and this is connected, of course, it ends a dying person's end-of-life suffering. Hi, Patricia, are you there?
I am.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for joining this conversation. I'm sure you realize that Death with Dignity is somewhat controversial, and so I was hoping to get both sides of the act discussed. I do remember, am I right, that there were not enough petitions to submit to have a referendum on the ballot?
That's right. You know, first of all, thank you for inviting me on. It's a topic I enjoy speaking about because we only have one death, and everyone should at some point start to think about that one death and what they want to do with it. But that's true. The referendum was not on the ballot because not enough signatures were collected.
Do you think there'll be another effort to challenge the law?
I haven't heard of any.
How did you first get interested in this subject, Patricia? What's your motivation and background? I know you're a doctor, so that must be part of it help people.
I'm a neurologist, and I was in private practice for almost 30 years, and I closed my practice and ran for the legislature, and I'm now in my third term, running for my fourth term, representing the fine people of District 4, which is parts of York, Wells, Sanford, and all of Ogunquit. And during the time I practiced neurology, both in an inpatient and outpatient setting in the Seacoast the Seacoast area of southern Maine and the Seacoast of New Hampshire, I was chairperson of the Medical Ethics Committee. And through that experience and being a neurologist, because in neurology we diagnose disorders that last a lifetime, and I've walked the walk with families and people through their lives through my almost 30 years of being in a stable practice. And many people came to the point of death, and I was aware that they didn't have options. You know, you could fight your way through life to death and be on every machine you wanted to, and that's fine. And for some people, they want to do that and go out fighting. Other people find solace with hospice and palliative care and
and that system works for them. But there are other people who want to have real control over the date and time and place and people they're around, and that's really what this bill is all about.
And Valerie told us that concern about this issue in Maine, death with dignity, goes back to 1994. So it must have been very satisfying for you to have this legislation passed.
Yeah, so I really didn't know about this legislation until I was in the was a representative and in the committee I'm now chair of. I'm House Chair of the Health and Human Services Committee. It was my first term, and it was kind of like drinking from a fire hose, you know, just so much coming at me at once in a new political position. And there was this bill, this Death with Dignity bill, and I thought, wow, this really grabbed my attention. And I thought, so I watched the public hearing, and it was a full-day public hearing, and I listened to everyone, pro and con, and so the next year when I was, the next session when I was reelected, I reviewed the bill with the sponsor at that time, Senator Roger Cates, who was the senator from Augusta, and we went through it, through the bill, and talked about how to make it really be a Maine bill, based on our understanding of the public hearing. And so the next session, I put it in myself as the sponsor, and again listened to the entire public hearing to then make some changes in it to make it really reflective of what we had heard in the public hearing. So I really feel like this bill had great input from people in Maine who chose to show up to the public hearing in Augusta and speak what was in their heart.
What were some of the changes that were made by you and Roger Cates as a result of these hearings?
Well, they were just little things, because most of the bill is from the experience in Oregon, and we were impressed with the Oregon experience because they have a law there that's 25 years old. And it really has not gone through any substantive changes. I think the first small change they had was just this session. But we were impressed that the bill has worked for them for that long. And so the majority of the wording comes from the law in Oregon. And there were some small changes that we made reflective. And I'd have to go back and see which, you know, figure that out, but
yes,
they were not hugely substantive, but still informed by those public hearings.
Well, that must have been a good strategy to create this bill with Maine people's concerns in mind.
Yeah, that's something I've learned being a legislator here, is that, you know, Maine's a special place. I've lived here for 35 years in my district along the York River and raised three kids here. My husband's a cardiologist, and we really, you know, I've appreciated being in the political space now, and also having been a physician here taking care of people. So I've learned that Maine people want something to be created here out of conversations that that happen. So I was glad that I had, you know, two big public hearings to inform the bill.
That's very good. I suppose our relatively small population and the fact that we have a very high percentage of older people, those two factors must have been important in getting this legislation passed.
Yeah, there was definitely a groundswell. And, you know, there are so many side conversations that I became aware of, like, you know, even in my own town of York. I was in the library this weekend, and there was a notice for a death cafe, and those are people who just want to come and sit around and talk about, you know, what's going to go on with their death and what's the possibilities. And I haven't been to one, so I'm going to attend that I think next Saturday or Sunday, something like that.
Is that starting in Southern Maine, do you think? I haven't heard of any death cafes down east, but...
Well, there it is, yeah. So there's one in New York at the library.
That's very good. And since you represent Algonquin, Patricia, you must know about Harbor Chocolates.
Oh, my goodness, of course. Yeah, oh, I have to, if I'm on the... I have to put in a plug for Algonquin because pretty soon it spruces itself up in just beautiful ways with flowers. I kid around and say we polish every grain of sand on the beach, but it really is a beautiful place to come in any season. And
thank
the chocolates
you.
Are delicious.
Thank you so much, Patricia, for being on our program today, WERU, All About Aging. Now we're going to go back to Valerie Lovelace and... She will continue to talk about death with dignity, and I have a few comments from hospice representatives who have concerns about this act, death with dignity. For example, the head of hospice volunteers of Hancock County, Jody Wolford Tucker, says that hospice and palliative care have offered an end-of-life process that honored the dignity of the people involved. She's concerned that the new law will cause confusion in the community. It's very important to have both. It's very important to make a distinction between death with dignity and hospice. Valerie, you're back online on the air.
I am.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I can hear you too. I had just, before we talked to Patricia, I was going over those pro sides of death with dignity. Let's see, the choice, ending suffering, autonomy, that's an important one. I actually think, as an old English teacher, that self-autonomy is redundant, but if self-autonomy is what they say, we'll accept that. And the fourth one, it does not replace end-of-life care. Could you say something about that?
Yes, this is actually fully compatible with hospice care. In fact, you know, I encourage folks to, if they are terminally ill, to consider hospice care, to ask a lot of questions about it. Being a former hospice volunteer myself, I think it's a beautiful service, a way to be comfortably in your home for as long as possible. Also to have a high quality of life for as long as possible before you begin, the downhill decline toward imminent death. So I think it's really important that people understand this is not an either-or thing. This is a both-and thing. You can have hospice and palliative support, and you can use the Death with Dignity Act if that's something you want to choose.
It's important to make that point. I have a couple other notes here from Hospice of Hancock County. Our purpose is to provide the means and support for an end-of-life journey that is as comfortable and natural as possible, while seeking neither to artificially prolong life nor to hasten death. Jody Wolford Tucker wants to assure listeners to our program that hospice will continue to serve patients with compassion and care without regard to other services they may take advantage of. In other words, a patient's decision to use this option will not preclude them from receiving hospice services. I think that's a very important point, isn't it?
Yes, I do.
One more thing here on the opposition side, or at least the sign of concern. Opposition is perhaps too strong a word, but hospice has concerns. I know that Candace Powell of Maine Hospice Council has spoken out against death with dignity. And here I have a statement from the Catholic Archdiocese of Maine. Quote, the passage of a physician-assisted suicide legalizes a practice which has a devastating effect on the common good. Suicide is always a tragedy. Allowing doctors to prescribe deadly medications to hasten a person's death is a horrendous wound to the dignity of the human person. With this law, the elderly will feel undue pressure to view this as an option to prevent being a burden to others. There will be a further desensitization of the value of human life, and young people will now think that people can and should be disposable. This law devalues individual human life and the essential human bonds that cause us that call us to value one another and to care for one another. I don't see a date on this, but I know that the Archdiocese of Maine was involved in lobbying against death with dignity in Maine.
Yes, that's true. And I think it's important to point out, first of all, that the administrative representatives of organizations, even though they speak with authority and they speak on behalf of their entire membership, not everyone agrees with them. So I know there's a majority of Catholics who actually support death with dignity laws, and I also know that there are many people in the hospice organizations who support patients' choice with the Death with Dignity Act. So, you know, to say, I think it's overgeneralizing to say that all Catholics are opposed to this, or that all hospice people are opposed to this, because it's absolutely not the case.
I think that's a very good point. And it's not physician-assisted suicide, is it?
It is not. That's a very incorrect term. I think, opposition uses that term often because it does incite some emotion and fear and concerns. But it's a very inappropriate term. You know, I have a family member who died by suicide. It's a very different kind of death. And those are generally related to depression or mental illness or other complications. But these are not, these are terminally ill people who are dying, and they are simply making a choice of how they want that to go, not whether it will go. They don't have an option to go on living.
That's a good point about some Catholics, perhaps many Catholics, supporting death with dignity, and certainly many hospice workers, like the ones you met at the Berkeley Conference, are supporting
and here
choice.
In Maine.
Yes, good. What else should we say, Valerie, about death with dignity? It's a new law. It has it's been carefully crafted to avoid abuses of it. What else?
If anyone has questions, they can go to our website, which is MaineDeathWithDignity.org, or to the National Death with Dignity Center website, which is simply DeathWithDignity.org, to get more information if they need it. They can also email me through the MaineDeathWithDignity.org website if they have questions. We have information on our website for providers, for patients and family members. And I am happy to speak with anybody or go to any place to speak to help people understand the law and how to access it.
Very good. Very good. Can you speak briefly to some misconceptions about the new law? You mentioned one earlier.
So the first misconception, of course, is, I already have an advance directive. I'm covered.
Yeah.
If a person wants access or is considering access to the Maine Death with Dignity Act, that's a very different process than an advance directive. I encourage everyone to have an advance directive. And more importantly than that, to have conversations with their loved ones about, what happens if I'm in a car accident? What happens if I have a terminal illness? This is how I want to die. And just as an example, it's pretty easy to make assumptions about what's going to happen. You know, my sister died at the age of 49. Her husband was 12 years her senior, and they always assumed that he was going to die first because he was older. Well, that didn't happen. So the fact that she was diagnosed with a terminal illness at such a young age just threw everything off, and they had never had that conversation. So, the thing I'd like to tell people is talking about death is not the thing that's going to kill you. I meet seniors who say, my kids don't want to talk about it with me, and then I meet their adult children, and they say, Mom and Dad don't want to talk about this. It is not difficult to talk about dying. I know a lot of people feel it is, but I'll tell you, as soon as you have that first conversation, it gets so much easier. And I think it's really necessary that the people who love you know what it is that you want when you're dying, so that they can be supportive of whatever those wishes are. I think that's absolutely essential.
That's important.
Other misconceptions are that that people with dementia can access this law, and that's not true. They absolutely cannot.
Uh-huh.
And I think those are probably the two biggest misconceptions. Other than there are still a lot of people in Maine who don't even know that it's passed yet.
And
my goal now is to continue educating in the state, continue getting the correct word out so people know, yes, the law does exist, it is acceptable, and our website will have all the information they need, including physician forms and things like that, to help them gain access to it. I also want to take my hat off to the Maine Centers for Disease Control and to the governor who signed the bill into law. But the Maine Center helped develop some of the rules around how data gets collected and reported so that when the law went into effect on September 19th, everything was ready to go. All of the underpinnings were in place so that physicians could work with their patients who wanted to gain access to the law. So that was a big effort. You know, the law was signed on June 12th, and then everything was ready to go by September 19th.
I'm
pretty proud of the state of Maine. I'm proud of Representative Hymanson and the other bill sponsors and all of the members of the legislature who voted to support this law for the people of Maine.
Since it's a relatively new law, Valerie, I'm wondering if there's any thought of collecting some research to indicate either broad support or broad opposition, or even anecdotal material would be interesting from families who
process. Well, and there's a huge body of research already based on the Oregon experience. I mean, they really pioneered this for the rest of the United States 25 years ago. So there, you know, are journal articles and research based on not only, you know, how patients view it, but how providers view it and how it works. So, you know, it's pretty easy to find that information. I would caution folks, if you just go onto the internet and Google for death with dignity, you may not find all factual information. In fact, you'll find a lot of misinformation. So I think folks need to be very selective about, you know, the sourcing of information that they're trying to get.
Where does the misinformation come from?
It tends to come from those opposition groups that don't want anybody to have access.
I see. And would these be Maine groups or national groups?
Both.
I was thinking,
You know, and it's unfortunate because if a patient or a provider is trying to find information about the law, it's very easy to get the wrong information. And, you know, some of the things I've heard here in Maine are, you know, things like the medication is so cost prohibitive, nobody could ever access it. I actually heard that from a hospice person, and it's absolutely not true. You know, I've heard that, you know, a patient has to drink a gallon of fluid in order to take their medication. Totally not true. So I think, you know, it's really necessary that people go to good sources to get the information they need. And, you know, like I mentioned, the Maine Death with Dignity site has some information on it. And if you're asking your physician for information, I encourage physicians to educate themselves, whether they're going to support patient decisions or not, to really understand what the law is and what it isn't, so they're not misleading patients who are asking about it.
How about the cost, Valerie? I'm sure it varies, but
It does vary. I have heard here in the state of Maine the cost of the medication is somewhere around $400.
That's a lot. I'm sure a lot of people couldn't afford that.
Yeah, that can feel like a lot, but previous medications that were being used were actually up in the thousands of dollars. So it's actually, you know, if your private insurance company is not supporting with a copay situation, it can feel like a lot out of pocket, which is why it's recommended that a patient not fill the prescription until they're certain they're ready to use it.
That's an interesting issue, though, isn't it, given the fact that it might be restricted at this time to middle-class people.
To people who can afford that, yes, mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, the formulas were put together. It was developed by a group of physicians from Washington and Colorado in response to the rising cost of the medication that was being used, because they felt like, you know, cost should not be the deterrent factor.
It's possible, I suppose, in the future that some public-spirited person will donate enough money to make this available to broadly available to the people of Maine, bring the cost way down.
Well, I'll tell you what, that would be fantastic if were somebody who wanted to donate or establish a trust fund that would help patients financially access it if they couldn't afford it otherwise, so long as they're qualified by their physician appropriately
yes.
under the law.
Well, going back to the anecdotal evidence, it seems to me that if I were considering this, reading stories of people who'd gone through it might be helpful in making me decide whether
sure.
or not this was a good choice.
Yes, yeah, and there are a lot of stories available like that from the states who have more experience than Maine does.
Anything else we haven't covered, Valerie? We're running out of time, but I appreciate your thoroughness in taking us through this process and explaining us and giving us the website information as well.
Yes, I really appreciate being on today. I got to listen to the bit with Representative Hymanson. I streamed that. That was really nice to hear from her again. And again, I just encourage folks, if they have questions, please visit our website, and I'll do my best to make sure they get the answers they need for it.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Valerie Lovelace, who's the Executive Director of Death with Dignity in Maine. In March, we'll hear from Gordon Bach and Carol Rohr. They'll be talking about the benefits of music for healthy aging and playing some songs. Also in March, the AARP representatives will talk about their issues for the next legislative session. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader, and thanks to our engineer, Amy Brown.
Support for WERU comes from Easterly Wine of Belfast, Maine, an independent enterprise that supports free speech, democracy, and independent media.
Welcome to 2020 Talks.